give my life and all I have. And I want to know, will you be there?
All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Welcome to the show, all right? We have a packed show for you today, so I'm just going to jump right into this. The back end of the show, we're going to hear a clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, responding to the question, why does private ownership of the means of production result in the oppression of women? You definitely don't want to miss out on that one. Before that, we'll be talking with Emilia Bano, who's co-founder of Shout Your Abortion, on fighting the stigma imposed on women who choose to have an abortion. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Cade Crockford, who's director of the Massachusetts ACLU Technology for Liberty program on the FBI, the targeting of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Bureau's present attempts to acquire advanced technology like facial recognition software. And I got to tell you, folks, if this doesn't disturb you when we talk about this, if this doesn't disturb you, you got to go out and stick a hand in a bucket full of fire because you've got to wake up. This is actually this is a really, really disturbing and enraging development that's going on here. So without any further ado, let me welcome Cade to the show. Cade, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away because I got so many questions in so little time here. Okay, you begin your article on what's going on with the FBI and Amazon, and Amazon in particular, Amazon's facial recognition product. And you begin that by talking about the spying and sabotage done to Martin Luther King. And it's important because, you know, when I say Amazon and FBI, it's kind of, it doesn't always, it takes a little, it's still taking a little bit of time to put those two together, but it shouldn't. And when you talk about the, when you compare that with the spying and sabotage to King, I think it actually helps set things in the proper perspective. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, many people will recall that former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who's known as basically the patriarch of the modern FBI, had it in, not just for MLK, but also for black activists generally, for Vietnam War resistors, for women's rights activists, gay rights activists, indigenous activists, you know, Latinx activists. He really was opposed to any left of center organizing that was challenging the patriarchal white supremacist status quo. MLK obviously was, you know, one of the most famous and successful and well-known and inspiring of those activists in the 1960s. And so J. Edgar Hoover was basically fanatically obsessed with undoing MLK and silencing him effectively. So your listeners are probably familiar with the FBI's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, which was a nationwide FBI attempt basically to destroy not only the civil rights movement, but the anti-war movement. And Hoover, when he spoke publicly about subversion, as they called it, would reference communism, right? You know, the white supremacist line in the United States about the civil rights movement was that it was infested with communists and, you know, foreign saboteurs. And, you know, to this day, there are actually people who justify the FBI's surveillance of Martin Luther King and many other activists and radicals at the time by essentially smearing them as Russian agents. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? A little bit. But in any case, back then, when the FBI was targeting college students, black activists, you know, religious leaders like Martin Luther King, it was using the technologies of the 1950s and 60s. So what are we talking about? Well, wiretaps. You know, we know that Bobby Kennedy actually signed off when he was attorney general on a wiretap that the FBI sought to monitor Martin Luther King's private phone conversation. We know that someone very close to Martin Luther King, a photographer who was from Memphis, Tennessee, actually worked as an FBI informant. And all of the many beautiful photographs that are, some of which are quite famous, that he took of leaders of the civil rights movement as they were doing their organizing and their work, made their way into the FBI's hands, and that he was informing the FBI, you know, on a day-to-day or weekly basis about what was going on internally in the movement. So informants and things like wiretaps and regular analog photography, that was how the FBI amassed its many, many thousands and thousands of pages of records documenting the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement of the 1950s and 60s. Today, we live in a vastly different world. Unfortunately, the FBI remains a political police force. hell-bent, it seems, on, you know, interfering with and potentially even destroying left-wing and civil rights organizing. Now the FBI calls Black Lives Matter activists, quote-unquote, black identity extremists. We learned about that last year. So this is just right out of Hoover's playbook. You know, unfortunately, not much has changed in that regard. But what has changed is the technologies that the FBI has at its disposal in terms of, you know, how it is able to collect information about people and monitor people. And that's where this conversation about face recognition technology comes into play.
Well, let's... Let's jump into this because it's really important. And they actually, the name of this thing is what? Recognition or recognition? You can continue with what you're going. We have about 12 minutes and I don't want to miss anything. So let's jump into, let's just keep the way you're going. But I wanted to make sure we get into that pretty soon, the recognition question, because this is actually, this is a whole other advance and a whole other move, a repressive move on the part of the system here. And I think it's important that people...
Right.
Get that.
Right. So labor organizers are probably familiar with Amazon, the company that, you know, allegedly works its warehouse workers so hard that they have to pee in water bottles because they don't have time for bathroom breaks. You know, Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, is one of the richest people in the world. Amazon is one of the most profitable companies in the world. And it is not just selling you trinkets to your house. Amazon has a huge cloud services business, which anybody who works in the technology world will know very well, called Amazon Web Services. And Amazon is now coming out with a suite of products, artificial intelligence products, that help businesses and governments make the most effectively of its cloud service operation, AWS, and the huge amount of computing power that we have available to us right now for very little money. So Recognition, its face surveillance product, is one of these technologies that Amazon is making available to customers that use AWS cloud services. And wouldn't you guess that the FBI is one of those entities? So for the past, I don't know, 5 or so years, the FBI and every other intelligence agency in the 17-member so-called intelligence community in the United States has been working with Amazon. The CIA signed a contract with Amazon a number of years ago to hook up all of the intelligence services with Amazon so that that large company can provide cloud services for the intelligence community. So what we just heard relatively recently, a couple months ago, is that Amazon is now working with the FBI to offer a pilot program so that the FBI can test Amazon's face recognition technology, and presumably that's happening over this cloud service platform that, that Amazon has already been providing to the FBI for a number of years. So this is terrifying for a number of reasons. First, because, again, we know what the FBI is, we know what it's about, we know that it has a really nasty history that stretches into the present of targeting climate activists, of targeting black activists, indigenous activists, and anybody else who has a problem with the, you know, racist capitalist status quo. And we also know that the FBI has access to millions of images of people's faces. So, you know, in order for face recognition to work, really, the government needs a data bank, effectively, of images connected to people's personal identifying information so that they can, for example, identify somebody in a photograph or take a video camera to a protest and get a bunch of footage of who's at the protest and then plug that into potentially the recognition system and, boom, you know, run that against a database of existing images that the FBI possesses of hundreds of millions of people and their personal information and automatically produce a list of everybody who is at that protest. This is the type of absolutely chilling, anti-democratic, even authoritarian surveillance that China is currently engaged in. People may be familiar with China rounding up the Muslim minority Uyghur population. They've been using face recognition technology in their authoritarian campaign to target the Uyghurs. And we will see the FBI inevitably use face recognition for those very similar types of purposes, targeting religious minorities, targeting dissidents, if we don't stop it. So the ACLU has cobbled together a coalition of almost 100 organizations nationwide civil rights, religious, civil liberties organizations that are calling on these big companies, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, not to sell this powerful technology to the government. And we're not just talking about local police or FBI here. ICE is now potentially engaged in contracts with Amazon related to its face recognition product. The companies have responded differently. So Google basically has said, you know, it's not sufficient for Silicon Valley to say, well, we'll build it and then fix it later if it screws up society. They've said, you know, we actually have real concerns about what face recognition technology will do in the United States, and therefore we aren't releasing a face recognition product yet until those current concerns are addressed. Microsoft has said, we are releasing a product, but we are very concerned, and we think the government ought to regulate this technology so that civil rights aren't abused. Amazon, on the other hand, is effectively just putting its fingers in its ears and saying, we don't care what the ACLU says. We don't care what all these civil rights and civil liberties and religious groups say. We're going to sell this stuff to the police. We're going to, you know, potentially sell it to the FBI and to ICE, even though just today a new study is reported by the New York Times showing that not only is this technology definitely going to violate people's rights if it's used, you know, in the context of identifying people on the street, which, you know, it'll clearly be used to target black and brown people in the war on drugs, in racist police structures throughout the United States, and in the context of dissidents identifying people at protests, but right now, Amazon's technology and many of the major companies' face recognition algorithms, this study showed, are bad at identifying dark-skinned people. So there's actually a problem with algorithmic bias in the technology right now. These systems are not ready to roll. They're very poor at identifying women's faces. They're poor at identifying dark-skinned women specifically and black people more generally. And this is, of course, related to the problem of bias in technology generally and the overwhelming whiteness and maleness of, you know, who works at these engineering firms. But regardless, we're faced with a number of problems. The FBI remains a political police force. It has these shady dealings with Amazon, and they're potentially going to expand this nationwide if we don't stop it, this face recognition system. And then third, this system is entirely unregulated. There's no meaningful regulation anywhere in the country on government's ability to use these systems. And finally, the systems themselves are not accurate. So we really need to pump the brakes as a society. Here in Massachusetts, we are calling on the state legislature to pass legislation that was just introduced that would basically press pause. It would say, now there's a moratorium on government use of face recognition technology, you know, in part because of these unresolved bias issues within the technology, but in part because even if the technology worked 100% accurately, we are not ready. We have not had a sufficient debate about what the appropriate limits should look like for the government's use of these tools, and those limits ought to and must exist before police departments and entities like the ICE, the FBI and ICE start using this stuff in the wild.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to actually just sort of recap some things because I want people to understand that this is not something that's like waiting to be put into motion. That this is actually, there are forces that are actually using this now. The impact that this is going to have in society is extreme. You think of the science fiction novels that we all read 20 years ago, and this is like way beyond even that, you know? And the idea of this actually being, basically, it's being marketed, but it's being marketed, you know, and people can argue, well, it's being marketed as just sort of a new advance in technology. But it is actually, I think, a major step in the fascistization of society as a whole. And this is an incredibly important thing for people to stand up against now.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. A world where there is unrestrained face recognition in use by government entities like the police and ICE and the FBI is a world where we have no anonymity and no privacy, period. I mean, right now, you know, we certainly have a lot of problems with respect to government surveillance and the ability for government and corporations to track us everywhere we go. But you can leave your phone at home if you want to, right? You cannot leave your face at home. There is no way that you can escape a face recognition system if it is built in a way that's omnipotent and once the technology is actually accurate enough to be able to track people when they're in motion. And that's, you know, that's happening fast. I expect that to be the case within the next 10 years. So, you know, that world looks like, imagine Deep Throat, right? The source for the Watergate scandal stories that the newspapers published in the 1970s. That source is not able to be anonymous in a world in which there are surveillance cameras in the parking garage where he met with that reporter. He's unmasked immediately, right? Mm-hmm. It is not possible for journalists to meet with confidential sources in a coffee shop in a world where there's face recognition enabled cameras on every street corner. It is not possible for someone to attend a Narcotics Anonymous meeting without being automatically cataloged by one of these systems as someone who's seeking treatment for substance use disorder. It is not possible for someone to get an abortion without being documented by the government by one of these cameras in a world in which these cameras are ubiquitous and equipped with face recognition. And these are just a few examples of, you know, the degree to which we will really suffer individually and as a country if this type of technology is allowed to roll out unimpeded. So again, at the ACLU, we are doing two things. We're calling on these companies that have a responsibility to their customers and frankly to, you know, living in a democratic society and to protecting democracy, that they not sell this technology to government entities, period. And we are calling on governments, both at the local level and at the state level, to essentially press pause or to say outright, we are not going to use this technology, period, because even though it may, in some very limited circumstances, have a public safety benefit, it will inevitably, it is guaranteed that it will harm democracy and individual rights, and it is too dangerous. And we actually have to either press pause or just stop altogether and decide collectively that this is not the kind of future we want to live in.
All right, Cade Crockford, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
And, thanks so much.
And how can people find out more about it if they want to get that real quick? How can they find out more about this
whole
situation?
There's tons of information online. Just search for ACLU face recognition and you'll find plenty of resources.
All right, Cade, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Sure, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Cade Crockford, director of the Massachusetts ACLU Technology for Liberty program on the FBI, the targeting of Dr. Martin Luther King, and really much, very, very important, the new technology, the Bureau's present attempts to acquire advanced technology like facial recognition software. And, folks, they're coming real close to having that working, okay? So we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Cyndi Lauper and that song. Okay, I just wanted to run that song, all right? Girls just want to have fun. All right, right now, I recently had the opportunity to talk with Amelia Bono, co-founder of Shout Your Abortion, on fighting the stigma imposed on women who choose to have an abortion. So check this out. In the 1970s, as feminists fought for legalized abortion, a little graphic on a lapel button and bumper stickers became a pervasive social meme. No coat hangers. In 2015, after four decades of attacks on Roe v. Wade, a new wave of pro-choice movement hit social media. Seattle feminist Amelia Bono pasted her personal abortion story in defense of funding for Planned Parenthood. She's here to talk with us about this today because this was a very brave move and an important move and one that's absolutely necessary in the world today. I'm really happy to basically be joining Amelia Bono on the show today. Amelia, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And I'm not kidding. That was actually reading what you folks did was actually so invigorating. Okay. What you've done is so invigorating and needed in the world today. So let's jump into this. You're one of the founders of Shout Your Abortion. What is this group, or better yet, what's this movement?
So Shout Your Abortion, as you mentioned, emerged in this very organic way in 2015. It was around the time that the first attempts to defund Planned Parenthood by the House were occurring after a bunch of anti-choice terrorists and propagandists created a series of videos making it look as though Planned Parenthood was selling baby brains on the black market. And their federal funding was in jeopardy. I was someone who had had an abortion about a year prior to that at Planned Parenthood, which was the place that I'd been going for all of my sexual and reproductive health care for years. And I felt really, really just indignant at the fact that this incredible organization that had taken such beautiful, compassionate care of me was being maligned in this really just insane way by liars. And I didn't feel like there was a strong defense from progressives or even from the pro-choice movement at that time. It really sort of felt like people were saying, well, Planned Parenthood does pap smears and STI tests and birth control. And no one was saying, I stand with Planned Parenthood because they provide abortion. And I really didn't feel also like a lot of the pro-choice folks around me, myself included to some degree, were comfortable really rooting the core of our own convictions as pro-choice women in the fact that we had had abortions. So I just became aware of this silence, and it felt very much to me like this silence is being leveraged against us, and the only way that propaganda like the right is creating can survive is if we're not actually countering this narrative with the truth, which is that millions of Americans are living better lives because of having had abortions. One in four people who can get pregnant have an abortion, at least one abortion, at some point in their life for all sorts of different reasons. And these experiences feel all sorts of different kinds of ways. And the vast majority of us just have not really ever spoken about our abortions, or those of us who haven't had them haven't spoken to other people who have. So I think that there's just like a lack of human touchstones in this conversation, that it's been really polarized, and that the right has been able to effectively dehumanize the people who have abortions and the people who provide them, for that matter, because of a lack of speaking out. So that was a really long intro, but essentially what happened after I posted my first status update was that this hashtag, which my dear friend Lindy West, who's a brilliant feminist writer with a large platform, she posted a screenshot of my abortion disclosure on Twitter and added her own and the hashtag #ShoutYourAbortion. And within a few days, it had gone viral, and hundreds of thousands of people all over the world had used this hashtag to share their own abortion experiences, often for the first time. And now it's almost been, we're coming up on 4 years later, or I guess 3 years and some change, and SYA is in its third year as a nonprofit. We have nonprofit sponsorship is the technical term, but we are a full-blown organization and a full-fledged movement. We essentially work to create places in art and media and at real-life events all over the country for people to talk about their abortions on their own terms. And I am right now in Chicago. I'm about to run and catch a plane to Iowa City. I'm in the middle of a book tour. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at the book that I sent you, Michael, but it came out a couple of months ago, and it's really kind of, as much as a movement that is like incredibly undefined and decentralized and amorphous in some ways can be represented in a text, this book attempts to do that. And so there are abortion stories from people all over the country. There are just all different kinds of stories as well. The folks range in age from like 17 to 85, you know, just all over the life and gender and race spectrum. And there are also, there's a lot of documentation of art and other like projects and actions that folks have been inspired by Shout Your Abortion to do in their own communities. We recently, on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, projected a bunch of text onto the side of Trump Tower as well as the Supreme Court. So these are the kinds of things that we do. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, that was such a terribly long answer.
No, it's fine, but I'm just going to have to dig into some of the things that you said, because they were all my questions. No, but what I did want to get into was, you know, you think about this. It's really important that people understand what the movement came out of, what you've been saying in terms of what the movement came out of, and the fact that even though you had Roe v. Wade, there was still, and to this day, still remains to a large extent, a stigma connected with the idea that a woman would have an abortion. It's something that people grow up thinking it's a shame if they get one. They made a mistake.
Absolutely.
There's something wrong with them. And I thought that the way that you folks came out with this was extremely important. And the way that you continue to come out with it is extremely important, because as I think the statistic that you've mentioned is that a quarter of American women have abortions and 70% support abortion rights. But today, the access is being decimated. People think that, well, everybody can go get an abortion if you really want one. But the reality is there's a major assault going on. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. And I think that Roe versus Wade has been sort of, I think it gave us a false sense of victory in certain ways, especially since the Hyde Amendment was passed just a few years later and made it so that Medicaid can't be used to pay for abortions. And so essentially, like, from the get-go, it's been a pay for your own reproductive freedom like it's a commodity, like, you know, all other American health care. If you can't afford it, you're SOL. And we know that that's absolutely classist and racist and is meant to have those kinds of outcomes. That's why the Republican Party wants to take away abortion rights. It's not because they don't want their wives and daughters and mistresses to have abortions. It's because they know that working class folks who can't afford abortion care won't ever be able to get out from under poverty and generations of poverty and lead truly self-determined lives. But you're totally right. So even now, you know, when we've had Roe for 46 years now, there are 7 states with only one abortion clinic, and there are over 90% of counties in the United States with not a single one. And abortion care is really just effectively not accessible to millions of Americans. And so I think that, you know, those two things are connected. It's like, I just think about the stigma that continues and the fact that, like, even on the left, I think a lot of folks just sort of capitulated to a safe, legal, and rare kind of mentality, you know, or just like, yeah, you know, this thing, abortion, it's nobody likes it. It's not a good thing. And, you know, if you have one, you shouldn't talk about it. And if you do, you should be sorry. But we do ultimately need it as a society if you're in a really bad situation or whatever. It's like those talking points are so ingrained in even many, many progressive individuals that we really, like, lost the game. We lost the script, you know, like, and we just got on the defense about 20 years ago, I think, in the rise of the religious right and the moral majority. And they just figured that they could, the right just figured out how to keep us on the defense and make us apologize for something that ultimately the vast majority of people aren't sorry about. 95% of women don't regret their abortions. But you wouldn't know it by the way that we've been trained to talk about our own experiences, or not to, rather. So Shout Your Abortion really just wants to open up that discursive field so that we can, like, start just being real about what is actually going on and how people feel about it. Because I do believe also that people are a lot more compassionate than we give them credit for in this country. You know, it's like you said, 71% of Americans support Roe versus Wade. People are having abortions. These are not, like, bipartisan. Every single kind of person you can imagine has an abortion. And people know that this country relies on abortion care. It's just really stigmatized to come out and say that. And I think that the right has dominated that silence and used it to really implement policy that's just fundamentally out of touch with the needs and values of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this point that you're making, it's really important that people understand this, because no matter what has happened in terms of, yes, Roe v. Wade, what people have said all along, the advances, and there were some advances when women actually could go out and get abortions and not have to go to the sort of part-time garbage man down the street who also does abortions,
right,
and, you know, whatever. So it's like you're looking at this kind of thing and you're saying, and a lot of people look and say, well, what do you want? Women can get abortions, but there actually is a full-scale assault on not just the abortion providers, but also, and I've interviewed a lot of abortion providers over the last few years, and it's been very serious, the things that happened. I mean, you know, doctors, everyone, one doctor talking about having to, you know, wear bulletproof vests to go into work, you know, and it's really, it's a very heavy situation. And at the same time, something very similar exists for women, both because they're in a fight for their lives, literally, and because they're in a fight for their lives in terms of the society overall and the role and the position of women in society.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I saw that. I looked at your site, and I saw that you had interviewed Leroy Carhart, and it's actually what made me decide I wanted to chat with you today, in spite of the fact that I'm, like, running to the airport, because Dr. Carhart is a hero and a colleague of mine. I'm actually on the board of his new clinic that he just opened in Germantown, Maryland. And yeah, I think that what you spoke to is really real, and it does need to be just sort of said that the anti-choice movement has really normalized a situation where women, people who are going into clinics just to get care, are being harassed and threatened and abused walking in to get their health care, and that doctors like Dr. Carhart are, you know, Dr. Carhart's had attempts on his life for decades. He lost his dear friend, Dr. Tiller, about 10 years ago to an anti-choice terrorist, and that was after Dr. Tiller had been shot in both arms and still continued practicing, and his clinic was firebombed to the ground, and he still continued practicing. These folks are heroes, and, you know, and it shouldn't have to be this way. And I think that a really small minority of violent evangelicists, I'm having a brain problem with that word, but a small fringe minority have like taken this conversation and dominated it and have somehow made it so like they're the normal ones, that the people standing outside of the clinics and screaming at women who are going inside to have abortions are somehow the normal ones, that billboards on the side of the highway that have totally like photoshopped fake horrible triggering violent like photos of dead fetuses that are just meant to traumatize people, like that those things are normal and they're everywhere, and that somehow it's totally radical, it's totally fringe for a woman like me to say, hi, my name's Amelia, I had an abortion a few years ago, it wasn't anything that I felt any sort of shame or regret or really just, you know, it wasn't a negative emotional experience for me at all. What it was something that left me with a profound sense of gratitude and relief that I wasn't being forced to become a mother. And yeah, like I really believe that legislatively we're on the ropes, especially with Brett Kavanaugh, and, you know, the Supreme Court is just going to take like a generation to unscrew. But like culturally, the anti-choice movement is just about to be history, you know? They just don't have the numbers. And I think that the more and more and more that people speak out about their own experiences in whatever way that might feel comfortable, you know, it might just be telling one person. It might just be telling the people in your life that you want to make yourself available to them if they have an abortion that they want to talk about. You could start a book club with this beautiful new book that we just made. It's available through PM Press, and it's a really awesome conversation starter. But just to, like, make yourself an active part of that culture change, that's what we have to do in order to turn the tide in a way that is just simply irreversible. You know, no one was fighting for gay marriage when everybody was in the closet. And it's time for us to really start talking about our lives on our own terms. And every single person who decides to do that is making the world safer for future generations.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Amelia Bano, one of the founders of a group called Shout Your Abortion, a celebration of abortion in the lives of, well, actually in the lives of women and of all humanity. Now, one thing I wanted to ask is that, you know, that there's a question here, because when you were talking about this, it sort of really struck me is, yes, it's true that there's like a lot more women coming forward around this. And I was really impressed with the reaction to your book. But at the same time, we are living in a situation where we have Christian fascists, you know, and we have the mm-hmm. Trump is sort of the titular head of that, you know, in terms of what's going on with this. And the fact those people are insanely anti-abortion and anti-woman. And mm-hmm. I think it's really important mm-hmm. that we actually think about, you know, the importance of what you're doing in terms of, like you've been talking about, that this approach that you have in terms of how to actually how to speak to the question of whether abortion is good, bad, whatever, that it's really important that people recognize that, one, the book that you put out is an important expression of that kind of movement, but it's women telling their stories is a form of resistance, and it's also a form of the celebration of life. And I wanted to talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that that's when we've all been taught to think about this conversation in such a purely theoretical kind of political football sort of way. And we just haven't had the stories that can really like humanize and help us just relate to like what this actually is. You know, it's kind of always just been this weird debate about, you know, personhood and when life begins, which that was definitely a pivot that like that the moral majority and Christian right made in the late 80s and early 90s and made it, they just sort of effectively rebranded abortion as murder and made it so that, like, anyone who wanted to argue with that was going to have to enter the conversation on those terms and essentially be totally, you know, making themselves available for dehumanization because you've already said, hi, I'm a murderer, now let's negotiate. But the thing that you bring up about abortion as a celebration of life and as a profound benefit to society, I mean, that's something that it's like, it sounds like a radical idea for most folks to think about, to think like, wow, you're saying abortion actually isn't bad, that abortion is good. And I think that all you need to do in order to make that statement make sense to you, if it doesn't, is start talking to the people in your life that have had abortions or engaging with material like what Shout Your Abortion creates, because abortion is not, you know, it feels different for everyone. It absolutely, like, there's just an infinite number of situations that make someone want or need to have an abortion. And the thing that it allows is the whole rest of your life. So, you know, in this book, we have stories from people who finally escaped abusive relationships and who got clean after being, you know, abusing substances and being, like, really down and out. And that they expressed their abortion being the first time that they ever decided that they were deserving of love and care from themselves and that they wanted to stay alive. There are people that talk about, you know, their current families that they have now and how they never, ever would have been able to be the parent that they are now if they hadn't have had the abortion that they had. There are people that talk about terminating medically compromised pregnancies and, you know, that broke their hearts, but, like, that them having access to that choice allowed them to not, you know, sit and take a pregnancy to term after and have a just absolutely horrific, life-alteringly traumatic delivery of a baby that's not alive. So, yeah, you know, I think that it's, I often just sort of feel like I don't need to try to convince anyone. I just want us to start telling our stories and the work sort of does itself.
Mm-hmm. One last question, and that is, again, this is the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and there's an importance for people speaking out. And I wanted you to speak to that because you yourself have spoken out. You've had your own experiences being targeted by the anti-abortion movement, but you've still you've stayed on a position where on a course where you're actually saying no. Women are human beings, and we deserve to be treated as such. That's the basic point. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that in relation to the anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, you know, I guess I would just say that, like I said, unfortunately, Roe versus Wade just hasn't ever really been enough to protect us. It's devastating to think about Roe versus Wade being overturned, and it's totally possible that that will happen. And at the same time, whether or not it does, we will continue to see access decimated at a state level for years and years to come. And so, you know, if you're a woman who lives in Mississippi and you couldn't make it across the state to get the abortion you needed and there was a waiting period in place that meant that you would have had to find childcare for 2 days and put yourself up in a hotel and you had a baby that you didn't want, you know, abortion is legal on paper because Roe versus Wade stands, but you have absolutely lost your right to autonomy. Like, that person, and there are many, many, many people who find themselves in those situations, those people, like, legality has not really, has been pretty illusory, I think, for folks that are poor and especially living in the Deep South. So, I think, like, I have a lot of respect and gratitude for the people who have fought to keep the abortion rights that we have in place and fought to hold the line and fought to push things forward, like we saw with the passage of the Reproductive Health Act in New York the other day, which essentially ensured that doctors could make a decision whether or not to terminate a pregnancy at any point, which is a really, you know, like those situations are just so unfathomable. And that's another reason why, you know, it's important to talk about this stuff. And there have been a number of like incredible articles written by women in New York who had to terminate pregnancies at like 32 weeks because you know, their baby wasn't going to survive. And those people and having to pay like $10,000 and travel to Colorado, and because there are only 3 abortion clinics in the country currently, one of whom is operated by Dr. Carhart, but there are only 3 clinics that would do a procedure that late in the country. And so you know, victories like that mean things. They mean incredible things to individuals in their lives, but we have to keep pushing. The current situation is absolutely not enough. We have to overturn the Hyde Amendment. That's really kind of where I think we're at with it. And I just don't think it's reasonable to expect that we will see just legislation and meaningful access for every person in this country until we start talking about abortion.
All right. One last question for you, and it'll be real quick, but tell people, one, how they can find out more about the group and what you've been doing and how they can get hold of the book.
Yes. So shoutyourabortion.com is our website. It's really cool. It's a place where you can add your own abortion story in text or video, and there are hundreds of stories on the site that you can view as well, and also like examples of art and documentation of all sorts of different projects that people have been inspired to do by Shout Your Abortion in the last few years, and you can sign up for our mailing list there. We only send about 1 email a month, and it's usually like some cool idea thing that you can do to get involved. And if you go to shoutyourabortion.com/book, you will see our beautiful book, and it's for sale for like $24. Also, if you sign up for our mailing list, we're going to be doing an offer probably in about 6 weeks to sponsor book clubs. So there will be an opportunity for you to potentially get a few free books if you wanted to start a group in your area and really just lead that charge to change the way that you and your community are talking about abortion. And you can, of course, find us on social media. I'm at Amelia Bono, B-O-N-O-W. Shout Your Abortion is at Shout Y-R Abortion on Twitter. And then on Instagram, we're at Shout Your Abortion.
All right, Amelia, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael.
All right, that was Amelia Bono. And we're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
I'm listening, I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. I can hear it waves through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes.
Welcome back. That's Here is the Rose from Outer National. All right, this next part of the program is, I'm really, really looking forward to playing this for you. It's a clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's responding to the question, why does private ownership of the means of production result in the oppression of women? This is part of a Q&A that followed a talk given in several cities in the summer of 2018, why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. To access the full film, plus clips and the Q&A, go to revcom.us. But to listen to this, and which you should really listen to this, check this out, let me know what you think about it, all right? So stay tuned. This is a clip from Bob Avakian.
I had 3 before, now I reduced it to 2. So the first one is in relation to the oppression of women and the material basis for why it cannot be resolved under the system. And, you know, you said that to abolish oppression of women, you need to abolish the private ownership of the means of production. And I understand you said that by referencing that oppression of women was, you know, emerged with the division of society in classes and, you know, with the development of private appropriation. So, you know, like, so that's a fact, you know, that's a fact. But right now, you know, like what we see right now with oppression of women is that it has taken all different kinds of forms. And it is very confusing for me to think about, you know, like how is it that private ownership of the means of production define that women must be oppressed? So I have a hard time like wrapping my head around that.
Oh, well, let me see. How many hours do we... Oh, no, this is a big question. That's what, you know, I look, the point is, if you want to talk about getting rid of the oppression of women, one of the things that you have to do is get rid of the whole family as it exists under capitalism and patriarchy as it exists. For example, how is private property, and I don't mean toothbrushes, but I mean wealth, how is that passed on from one generation to the next? It's not put into a common pool and then everybody draws from it, not under this system. It comes down through the family. So, you know, if you were trying to get rid of a system with all these vast disparities of wealth and so on, you couldn't maintain a system where the wealth was privately owned and then passed down through the family, because then you would just be perpetuating the system of exploitation and the inequalities that go along with it. So you would have to you'd have to get rid of the whole thing where wealth and the family are, you know, completely bound together, and the wealth becomes social wealth, which goes to people according to their needs and is enlarged by people contributing and according to their abilities. That's the goal you want to get to. So if you kept capitalism, if you're going to keep capitalism, then you would have to keep the family, the structure whereby things are consumed through the family. That, you know, like the capitalists and the religious fundamentalists are always telling us that the family is the basic unit of capitalism, at least many of them are. And it's true, if you think about how do people live, I mean, there are a lot of variations now. Some people don't, you know, some people aren't married. Some people don't have kids. Some people have kids and are not married. They're all different kind of variations. But in one form or another, the main way that people actually live and survive is through some kind of unit where, and let's remember, you have to raise future generations. So you have to have, the kids can't do for themselves when they're 2 months or 2 years old or 8 years old. So you have to have some sort of, under this system, you have to have some sort of system, some sort of unit through which that happens, and that happens through some kind of a family unit. Not all of them are headed by males the way they used to be. They're all kinds of different relations. But still, the traditional family still is the dominant institution in terms of what largely exists, even with all these changes. And if you look at the world as a whole, that's definitely true. Because this is a, let's keep in mind, we sometimes look only through the prism of what's right around us or just this country. This is a highly parasitic country. Another way to say that is it's the very high end of the food chain. You know, we're, you know, I saw recently a statistic that of all the people who work producing things, production workers in the world, 80% are in the third world, if you include China. So, you know, a lot of what we ends up on our, you know, plate or in our closet and our houses is made by people in all different parts of the world. And most of them are living in situations of the traditional patriarchal family. You know, so you, sometimes you can get things skewed just looking at what exists right around you in this country. But even here, if you, you know, there's still the unit where, you know, wealth and the ability to live comes through the family. And if you were going to keep the system of capitalism, you would have to keep that family. If you, you know, if you try to imagine passing on wealth through some other means under capitalism than doing it by inheritance and through the family. So then you got the question, well, can you have equality in the family under capitalism? If you're going to keep the family, can you get rid of the oppression of women in the family? Well, okay, first of all, again, there's the whole world, but then also within, just within this country, so let's even just leave aside the rest of the world, but which we can't, but just for the moment, even within this country, okay, in order to have, in a society which has the whole patriarchal tradition and, you know, the patriarchy has been, as I said, woven into the fabric of this society, in order to have no inequality, even within the family, you'd have to mandate that from the government. First of all, you'd have to say everybody has to enter into some kind of relation that makes up a family. And because we'd have to have some way that we're going to have inheritance and all the rest of it. All right, then you'd have to have the government under capitalism, if you're going to get rid of inequality within the family, where the women are not the ones who are doing most of the family work, even if they also have a job, you'd have to have the government come in and actually supervise that. What about all the people who aren't in families? Are you gonna make all of them get into families? This leads you to Handmaid's Tale type of stuff. The government also all of a sudden is mandating that everybody has to be in some kind of familial relationship, even if it's an updated version. You could have gay marriages and trans marriages and all kinds, but everybody has to be involved in some kind of family, and it all has to be equal. You can't have a division of labor that's unequal. Well, that means that you'd have to mean that everybody had a job that allowed them to be equal in the family. Because if some people had to work more than other people or at lower wages or so on, then one would become dependent on the other. Just, you know, why do a lot of women, for example, stay in these relationships where they're battered all the time? Even raped by their husband. Let's just say battered all the time. Well, partly it's, you know, they become convinced, you know, because of the culture, they become internalized their own oppression and become convinced that they must have done something wrong. But a lot of it is financial coercion. You know, that they may have kids. How am I and my kids going to survive? This guy is a terrible, he's a terrible tyrant, but he brings in the money that we need to live on. If I break away from him, how am I going to live? So this is a very common problem, you know. So how would you eliminate the dependence where one person is everybody going to have under capitalism the same job where they have the same finances, so that neither one would need to be dependent on the other financially? If you start going down the road with this, you can see how it's totally unworkable under capitalism. You have to get beyond all that sort of thing in order to have a situation where women would not be in the inferior position, given the whole way things have historically evolved. Now, you know, you can get islands of things in the professions and so on, where women can carve out a position of not being necessarily, but they still, you know, necessarily on the downside of an unequal relationship, or have no relationship at all with a man, can do that. But they're still living in the larger society and culture. I mean, look at the culture out here with regard to women. How can a woman really be equal and free of all the different expressions of oppression in a society like this one with this culture? You know, where, I mean, a tremendous amount of the pornography and strip club culture and all that is exactly in response to a section of women getting a certain amount of independence and position where they're not so dependent upon men. And so this is a way of reinstituting that, you know, it's not completely abolished, but, you know, it's a way of concentrating that subordinate position in a very grotesque way. Well, you may not be able to, you know, I saw a thing where a guy went to a strip club, and he was talking about how for $20 he could get this woman to strip. And he said, that gives me a real good sense of power, that for $20 I can make this happen. Well, think about that. You know, so this is what you're dealing with in the culture at large. So once you start really walking this through, you can see it's impossible. You'd have to transform the whole economy. It has to transform all the historically evolved relations between the genders with all the different variations to get rid of all of, like I said, all vestiges of oppression. And you have to thoroughly transform the culture. You know, and you, and under capitalism, again, if you walk through it, just can't be done. You cannot, the reason it comes back ultimately to the, to you, you were asking, why is it the question of the, you know, private ownership, the means of production? Why is it the mode of production? Why is it the economic system that's ultimately involved? Because of what I was walking through, it's, there are many other manifestations and forms, very real forms of the oppression of women that are not reducible to economic relations. And you have to go after all that. That's why I say you got to transform the culture, you got to transform all these social relations. But if you don't have an economy that allows you to do those things, then you're not going to be able to do it, no matter, you may be able to, like I said, fight and win certain reforms, but then, you know, they're only going to be partial and they're always going to be under attack. So you have to go after all these different dimensions of the oppression of all different people who are oppressed. But then you also have to transform the foundation of society, the economic system and the economic relations, in order to have the basis to really carry that through. As I said in the New Communism, you have to have a mode of production that doesn't prevent you from doing that, and which on the contrary actually fosters and facilitates that, makes it more possible to do that. So that's the relationship between all these different manifestations and the underlying economic system, or sometimes called the mode of production.
All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was actually a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And again, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank all of my guests today, Cade Crockford, Amelia Bono, and Bob Avakian. I also want to thank my board offer today, Lisette Tapia. Lisette, thank you very much. Pleasure working with you. There you go. And I want to tell you, if you want to check out all the guests I had on, check my Facebook page for all the links that my guests talked about, as well as how to access the film by Bob Avakian, BA, and all the question and answer sessions available. All right. And I haven't forgot him. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, all right, for all the work he does. He does a great job doing this. And we're going to be back again next week, so stay tuned for that. We're going to go out now with For What It's Worth from Buffalo Springfield. For all those people around my age, love this song.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong.